Available now from Graphic Audio.
There's some kind of trouble at Stack Island. Apparently personnel are missing. Believe lost at sea. We're to join the search. All right, we're going down.
Who are you?
Chief Stivers. And you are the missing Corporal Meharry? Where's Commander Bakaria?
She's dead, sir.
You had something to tell us?
Yes, sir. Commander Bakarian was one of Lupescu's followers.
Admiral Lupescu was using prisoners as prey. He was part of a secret society that held manhunts. They used human ears as recognition symbols.
Commander Bakarian's not in our offices, sir. The commander's not answering any call and the locator's not lit.
Ready to initiate bubble bath.
But sir...
Did you earn your ears, Sergeant?
Yes, sir.
Then hop to it.
They've got the orbital station. Bonartag picked up convicts from Stack 3 with its LACs and armed them. Use them as shock troops.
I'm a weapons specialist. I was on my way to Stack 2 to consult on the progress of some of their research. I happen to know that there are weapons under development there which you do not want the mutineers to have. If I were you, I'd figure out a way to send some troops out there to secure the base.
But we have no weather data, which is going to make it hard to fly from one base to another.
Commander, I'm telling you, if you don't secure that base and keep the mutiny from getting hold of those weapons, you'll wish you had to the end of your life.
There's something you must know.
Yes, sir?
You know the official history of the regular space service, how it is an amalgam of the private space-going militias of the founding families? The family we served was based on a single planet. That planet was Altiplano, your world. And, Esme Suiza, it's clear that your ancestors earned the enmity of mine by rebelling against their patrons and slaughtering them all.
What?
I don't believe it. I love her, and I admire her, and I'm going to marry her if I have to leave the family to do it.
There's been a mutiny on Copper Mountain. All leaves canceled. All personnel returned to their ships at once.
Nothing lasts forever.
I hope so.
Let's go.
Serrano Legacy, Book 6, Change of Command, Part 2. From Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Elizabeth Jernigan, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael John Casey, Richard Rowan, Michael Replogle, Dylan Lynch, Ren Casey, Colleen Delaney, Kate Foster, and Mort Shelby. Survivalist Midwake, Part 1. Major Olaf Karenin and Captain Boris Feodorovich stood over the man and the woman. Karenin could not give words to his thoughts. They were not Chinese, but he could not bring himself to think they were from Midwake, either.
Comrade Major, your orders.
Oh, Comrade Captain. Detach 6 men, one of them Nikolai Konstantin.
It was hard to imagine a solitary woman inflicting such casualties on a 6-man squad. Captain Feodorovich adjusted the microphone set into his helmet chin guard.
First unit, move out along the perimeter wall. Now,
He watched the lieutenant move his men forward, crouching in single file, their AKM-96s close to their chests. Fyodorovich looked to his own weapon, tugging at the 40-round magazine to make certain it was properly seated. He eyed the first unit's progress along the power station wall.
Second unit, begin penetration now.
Fyodorovich watched the second element move off toward his left, racing to the wall. The three squad leaders fired their pneumatic L-18 launchers from hip level. The grappling hooks flew to the top of the wall, their ropes uncoiling behind them. As the hooks connected, two men ran forward, deadweighting the ropes, then started the climb up the wall surface.
Third unit, advance on the wall. Penetrate now.
Fyodorovich was up, his corporal beside him as he ran. The three squad leaders of the third unit fired their L-18s. Fyodorovich climbed up the nearest of the three ropes. He could still make it up a wall faster than any of his men, even those half his age. Fyodorovich reached the top of the wall. From this height, he could see the setting sun. He flipped the safety tumbler in the AKM-96's thumb hole as he ran along the wall. Second unit personnel already moved along the perimeter. He watched as, soundlessly, they penetrated the guard tower. Second unit personnel were everywhere on the wall now, coiling their garrots, sheathing their knives. Dead Chinese bodies littered the catwalk. Fyodorovich stopped beside the guard tower. Two second unit men exited and pulled down the skeleton ladder. Fyodorovich tapped one of them on the shoulder, gesturing toward the open flap of his holster. The Spetsnaz secured it shut and ran on, unlimbering his AKM-96. Fyodorovich checked his chronometer. First unit would launch the decoy frontal assault on the entrance to the power station complex in exactly 43 seconds. He continued on along the wall, found suitable cover, and dropped behind it. He took another reading on the time. Then he armed his helmet radio over the inter-unit band.
We open fire on my signal. I fire the first shot.
He raised the weapon to his shoulder, fixing the integral carrying handle-mounted optical sight on three white coveralled Chinese standing in the courtyard of the administration building. Following Fyodorovich's opening volleys, his men opened a firestorm of gunfire. Explosive charges felled the power station's double gates. First unit poured over the downed gates as the smoke cleared. Chinese Defense Force personnel filled the courtyard.
Second unit, third unit demolition teams, move out.
Three men from each side of the wall hurled ropes over the wall, then rappelled at high speed into the courtyard. First unit personnel drew back toward the main gates, sucking the majority of the Chinese defenders after them. Fyodorovich slammed another 40 rounds up the well of his AKM-96. Light machine guns had opened up on both sides of the wall, firing into the courtyard. Fyodorovich moved along the perimeter to better observe the demolitions teams. As two men from each team put down suppressive fire, the third laid out long gray ropes of Synthex along the 10-meter-high walls of the domed powerhouse, setting detonators. But Fyodorovich's eyes were drawn away from the demolition teams. Three men near the gates, one dressed in the effeminate style of Chinese leisure attire, and two others in faded, light blue close-fitting trousers, military-looking boots, and ordinary shirts. The Chinese was wielding what looked to be a captured AKM-96. One of the other two men, his forehead high and his hair obviously thinning, fired some sort of antique firearm that looked like a hybrid of an assault rifle and a pistol. But he fired it with devastating effect. The third man was the tallest of the three, and the other two men flanked him. The man carried black pistols in either hand, firing as the three cut their way toward the powerhouse. The man with the two pistols, his thick hair blowing in the heat wind from the fires burning near the gates, looked extraordinarily fit, lean, yet powerfully muscled. The pistols in the third man's hands fired to empty. He stuffed them into the wide belt at his waist and drew another handgun, this unlike anything Fyodorovich had ever seen, yet its nature unmistakable. It gleamed in the light from the fires, and when it fired, a tongue of flame perhaps 15 centimeters in length licked from the barrel. The muzzle of the pistol rose as if from the concussion of the shot. Fyodorovich realized the pistol had to be of immense power, because even with his AKM-96 on full auto mode, its muzzle rise was minimal. And neither of the two men with the Chinese were Chinese. The taller of the two non-Chinese men, the one with the fantastically powerful handgun, closed on the demolition teams.
Demolition teams? What is apparently some special defensive unit is closing with you.
Fyodorovich raised his AKM-96 to his right shoulder, finding the tall man with the spectacular handgun in the rifle's optical sight. As Fyodorovich squeezed the trigger, the tall man vanished from his scope, and a member of one of the demolition teams took the burst.
Damn.
Fyodorovich found the tall man again.
He could see him, staring up at the wall. As Fyodorovich ready to fire, he recoiled, a tongue of flame leaping toward him as if through the scope itself. Fyodorovich fell back on his knees now, hands shaking as they grasped his rifle. Saw the tall man, a knife in his right hand, the gleaming pistol inverted in his left hand like some sort of mighty hammer as he attacked the demolition team nearest him. His knife hacked into one man's throat, the butt of his pistol lacerating another man beneath the lip of his battle helmet. The Chinese and the man with the thinning hair joined him now, closing with the second demolition team.
Unit 2 and Unit 3, concentrate all fire on the three men attacking the demolition teams at the powerhouse!
But as he said it, Fyodorovich realized it was too late. Chinese defense forces seemed to rally, pushing Unit 1 forces back through the gates. Other Chinese defenders taking up positions of cover and concentrating heavy automatic weapons fire on the walls. Fyodorovich looked once more to the Chinese man and his two unorthodox companions. They had AKM-96s now, firing at isolated groups of Spetsnaz still inside the compound, the effect of their fire devastating. With a dozen men like these, Fyodorovich realized he could do anything.
First unit, withdraw to the assembly point and control the main entrance into the compound to cover withdrawal of second unit and third unit from the wall. First unit, break off now!
Fyodorovich moved to the outer edge of the wall. Three men had turned another easy victory in the long history of lightning raids against the Chinese coastal deployments into the first defeat suffered at Chinese hands since the raids began. He looked back once.
Second unit, disengage now! Third unit, support second unit's withdrawal with suppressive fire into the compound! Move out, second unit!
Fyodorovich hurled his repelling rope over the wall, planting the scatter-frequency detonator, flipping the lock, setting the timer for 3 minutes, activating the detonator switch, then flipping back the lock into the closed position.
Third unit, disengage now! Move out!
He locked the carabiner on his utility belt into the modified figure-eight descender and started over the wall, slinging his rifle onto his shoulder to free both hands. He was over the side, his left gloved hand feeding rope, his right controlling the rate of descent. As he reached the ground at the outside base of the wall, he unsheathed his knife and cut himself free of the line. A glance at his chronometer told him 2 minutes and 18 seconds remained until the scatter frequency detonator activated.
First unit! Cover withdrawal of second unit and third unit until you receive my signal. Second unit, third unit, withdraw to beach. Move out now.
Fyodorovich broke into a dead run, gunfire from the walls raining down on him from the Chinese defenders positioned along the wall. Each Spetsnaz wore an explosives pack on his equipment belt, hard armored against any known projectile. Within the pack was a micro-receiver tuned to receive a specific three-band combination signal. Fyodorovich activated a scatter-frequency detonator only once before, years ago during his first cycle of surface training when recently commissioned as an officer of Spetsnaz. But during training, no one died. When the scatter-frequency detonator activated, any one of the Spetsnaz living or dead within a 200-meter radius would be vaporized.
First unit, remove belt packs. I say again, remove explosive packs. I have activated a scatter frequency detonator, which will initiate demolition in 57 seconds.
He kept running, but he had at least given first unit a chance. The ground rose sharply, and Fyodorovich and his Spetsnaz followed the rise, the smell of the sea beyond, powerful, seductive. He took a darting glance at his wrist and the diode count on his chronometer. As they cleared the rise, he knew they had more than the required safety margin. He heard the first of the explosions and kept running, seeing the ocean now, beckoning to him. Translucent wings. Bulbous heads. It was a dream. The creatures flew through what? Was it water? Rourke saw them through his window. He had not dreamed since the sleep, really. But this was a nightmare. He could not move. He could not wake up. Natalia was somewhere in the nightmare. He couldn't remember where. He watched the creatures as they moved through water. Yes, it was water surrounding him, but he wasn't wet. The creatures moved like birds, but these birds were at once monstrous and graceful. His mouth was dry. His head ached so badly that he wondered if, when he awoke, it would still ache. The light in the water was not natural light, but lights emanating from the winged creatures' heads and hands. There were things like huge sausages that bubbled through the water. These too had lights. He decided to try to move his head and perhaps the dream would go away. He moved his head and could see more through the little window. In the distance, there was a great black shape, substance out of shadow. He had seen something that big in the water before, but why was an aircraft carrier deep in the water here? The creatures with the translucent wings seemed to be lining up, like some sort of bizarre military formation, and he tried moving his head again to see better through the window. This was one hell of a dream, he thought. Perhaps his perceptions of such fantasies were so realistic because he hadn't dreamt since the sleep. Not that he could recall, anyway. The creatures with the translucent wings and bulbous heads were definitely slowing now. The aircraft carrier-sized thing was in fact a submarine, but of such monstrous proportions that in itself it was a more fantastic element of the dream than the winged creatures. It seemed so long as he floated closer to it that he could see neither stem nor stern. An Ohio-class Trident nuclear submarine. He searched for details. It was 550 feet. He shook his head. No, 560 feet. That was it. This was easily twice that length and beam of the vessel. They were gliding under it, the winged creatures extinguishing their lights as a yellow light flooded the water now. Rourke squinted against its brightness. The winged creatures hovered near the light. They looked more like giant insects than birds, he thought, flying around the light for its warmth and brightness. He doubted he would remember the dream, had never really made a conscious effort to remember a dream. Dreams had nothing to do with reality, he long ago convinced himself, and because of that, they were of little concern, except that they sometimes ruined a valuable sleep cycle. Some of the winged creatures drew their wings around them, folded them back, then slipped upward toward the light and vanished inside the monstrous submarine. He could barely keep his eyes open now. The light made his headache worse, made him want to stop the dream so he could sleep properly. The quarrel with Natalia was part of the dream, he realized now. When she told him she could no longer remain with him because of Sarah and the baby, when she told him that this war would go on forever and their lives couldn't go on this way forever, when he told her he needed her, and she cried and simply walked away along the beach, and he watched her instead of going after her. Nightmare. Losing Natalia would be the ultimate nightmare. More of the winged creatures vanished into the light, and now his eyes truly hurt, like an explosion going off in his head. He forced himself to look at something that looked at once cylindrical yet coffin-like. It was being manipulated into the light. A claw, huge, gleaming in the yellow light, came out of the light, took hold of the cylinder, raised it up into the brightest part of the light, and the cylinder was gone. Rourke kept watching, knowing somehow that the dream would end and he wouldn't see what was beyond the light. Some of the bubbling, sausage-shaped things the creatures clung to were being raised into the light by the gigantic, gleaming claw. He felt a change in motion around him and realized he was being drawn closer to the light. It hurt his eyes, and he squinted tight against it, the light getting brighter as he heard a clanging sound. The claw, he told himself. But as the motion around him stopped, then suddenly changed, and he felt himself being drawn up into the light, John Rourke closed his eyes completely. He realized he was waking up, and the dream would be over. John Rourke opened his eyes. The pain in his head told him that he had made the wrong choice, and he closed his eyes tight. A huge claw hung over his head.
That was stupid.
He opened his eyes. A talon-like crane hung some dozen feet over his head of bright polished stainless steel or some similar substance. The pain at the back of his eyes and in his neck was less intense than it had been. He tried to move his right arm. His right arm didn't respond. He shook his head. The pain intensified, but cleared his thinking. His wrists were bound behind him. He tested his ankles. They were bound as well.
Damn it.
John?
Rourke turned his head to the right. He shut his eyes against the pain momentarily.
John!
It was Natalia's voice. He shook his head again. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna lay some 10 feet or so from him, bound hands behind her back, ankles together, but lying on her stomach. He lay on his back. A puddle of water was around her on the steel floor, and for the first time he realized his clothes were wet and he too was in water. Beside her was a dull, gleaming, wet, black, cylindrically shaped coffin, the lid open, a small window visible in the lid. It hadn't been a nightmare at all.
Where... Are you all right?
My head is throbbing. They gave you some kind of injection. I think they gave one to me, too.
Let me... Where the hell... Let me think.
I think they shot us with some sort of sleep-inducing darts. I remember feeling something hit my chest while I was fighting. But I don't feel any sort of wound there. And I can see my jumpsuit. There's no hole there. And I started getting woozy like I was drunk. John, I have no idea what's happening.
She was frightened. He could tell it from her voice. He'd heard it in her only a very few times before.
Yeah, well, hang in there.
Rourke shivered with the dampness and the air temperature. He twisted his head to the left. There was a massive, watertight door, closed. Rourke tried to move his body. Pain shot along his back and through his legs. But he shifted position. He could see a hatch opening, a large wheel at its center.
Were you awake at all when we were...
It was like a nightmare. Those creatures with the wings and the big heads, did you see them?
Yeah. Did you see something that looked like it was a submarine, but the size of an aircraft carrier?
Natalia nodded her head, turning her eyes toward the floor. Rourke twisted his body, rolling onto his right side, flexing his fingers and wrists to restore feeling.
John, they took it. The little Russell knife. They took everything. They used some kind of metals detector. They swept both our bodies with it.
The guys from the beach?
They were wearing some kind of protective clothing, remember?
Dry suits, probably. Those transparent wings were some kind of propulsion system.
Rourke twisted his head left. The watertight door swung open, slammed against the bulkhead, bounced back, and a long, black-sleeved arm caught it. A man, tall, athletically built, stepped over the flange and framed himself just inside the doorway. His lean, chiseled face looked deathly pale, his pallor a striking contrast to the dark one-piece dry suit he wore and the overall good health his physique suggested. Heavy, bushy, dark brown eyebrows knit together in apparent thought. Above these rose a high forehead topped by close-cropped, thinning dark brown hair. His cold eyes seemed so darkly brown they appeared black. His nose was large, slightly hooked, almost classically American Indian in appearance. His mouth was overly large, and as he smiled, his parted lips revealed such perfect white teeth that for an instant, Rourke thought they were capped. Tellingly, his eyes remained cold as he smiled. His voice was emotionless and very low.
Who are you?
Rourke's mind raced. Natalia spoke, in German.
Who are you?
The man stepped completely through the doorway, and three other men followed him, all similarly black-clad. For the first time, Rourke detected subdued gold braid on the cuffs of the first man's dry suit, apparently rank insignia.
What language is this in which you speak?
We speak German, of course. What language do you speak? What do you want of us?
The first man turned to the other three and shrugged his shoulders, gestured them toward the compartment door. He passed through it over the flange, the other three following him. Rourke looked at Natalia. He gestured toward the doorway, and she nodded that she understood.
Who was that man?
Some sort of commander. I think I recognized him from the beach. Maybe they will realize that this is some sort of insane mistake. Are you all right, my darling?
Natalia looked at him and smiled. Rourke twisted around to see. The first man appeared in the doorway again, and this time, a man in what looked to be a naval officer's uniform was beside him. There was no way to tell specific rank, but judging from the lesser complexity of gold braid on the sleeves of the new man's blue uniform tunic, without lapels, buttoned high to the neck with no chin showing below it, he was of lesser rank. Nearly bald, slightly shorter, and considerably less fit-looking, the new man spoke in awkwardly accented German, as though he had never really heard German properly spoken.
You are both German nationals? How can that be?
Sir, this is some sort of mistake. Please, release us. My wife and I meant your men no harm.
This new man was definitely outranked.
Comrade Major, these two appear to be, well, German. They claim to be husband and wife.
The first man nodded his head thoughtfully, then walked over toward Rourke. He rolled Rourke onto his stomach. John Rourke could feel the first man's hands touch at the third finger of his left hand.
Why does this man wear a wedding ring, but the woman does not?
Why is it that you wear what is known as a marriage ring, and the woman you claim is your wife does not?
It was several months ago. We were exploring some old ruins much further inland. I stopped to rinse my hands in a nearby stream. The water was very cold, and when I pulled my hand back from the stream, the ring was gone. We searched, but never found it. Still, in my heart, I will always wear his ring.
Rourke looked at her, the surreal blueness of her eyes, the love there. He liked her lie better than his. He rolled onto his left side.
I demand that you release my wife and I. We have done nothing wrong. We were merely walking along the beach and your men set upon my wife. I attempted to aid her and was also viciously attacked.
Comrade Major, she claims she lost the ring while exploring ruins. They claim they did nothing wrong, that they only attempted to defend themselves against an attack.
The first man crossed the compartment again and stepped half over Natalia, one leg on either side of her.
Leave my wife alone, sir!
He demands you leave his wife alone.
The taller man knotted his fingers in Natalia's almost black hair and drew her head up, her back arching.
Tell this man that I think he and this woman are liars, and that I wish the real truth from them or I will cause them a great deal of pain.
Rourke tried to place a suitably puzzled look on his face as the balding man turned to him.
He does not believe you and promises much pain without you tell the truth.
Please, please do not hurt my wife. I will tell you anything you wish, but I can only speak the truth. We were walking along the beach. We are survivors from a community in the Western Hemisphere, which lived for many centuries underground after the Great War between the United States of America and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
Their people lived underground after the Great War.
Many of us. We left our homeland in these last years and began exploring the world in order to seek out others like ourselves who might have survived. We were elated when we discovered that some Chinese apparently survived there along the coast.
They say they are merely explorers, happy to find other people.
Rourke tried to think if there could have been anything he or Natalia might have had which could have linked them to the Chinese.
We were about to approach the Chinese. We lost most of our belongings during the recent blizzards. We ate the last of our food and were nearly out of ammunition. We had no choice. Are the Chinese your enemies?
They were about to ask the Chinese for help. They now wonder if the Chinese are our enemies.
It was time to stop giving information, however spurious, and start getting some.
My husband is telling you the truth. We are pleased that you have found us. We wish to be your friends, to tell our people that other people still survive on the face of the earth.
She says they wish to be our friends.
The balding man was catching up on the translation again, and Rourke caught the first man's eyes as Face of the Earth was translated for him. The smiling, icy-eyed Karenin turned to the balding man.
Tell them that they are either very innocent of who we are, in which case their interrogation will be long and painful and useless, or they are very good liars, in which case they will have the opportunity to tell the truth as convincingly, perhaps.
You must tell the truth, or you will suffer great pain.
The balding man completed his translation and left. John Rourke's and Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna's eyes met. He saw real fear in her eyes and imagined she saw the same in his. They lay bound, weaponless, beneath the sea, prisoners of a Russian-speaking enemy. This force, by all rights, could not exist, and yet was possessed of technology that appeared vastly superior to anything in John's or Natalia's experience.
We won't escape this, will we? We won't.
Rourke did not answer. The wind whipped the skirts of Hans' black dragon robe. Maria Leuden thought of her own skirt and realized that subconsciously her left hand already had her skirt under control. The wind that noisily buffeted Hans' garment was cold, and there was a heavy mist on the air, the mist visible as long streaks of gray against the whites and yellows of the flashlights Han, the Chinese security operative, and both Paul and Michael held in their hands. She had given up on holding her flashlight. It was in the wide, deep slash pocket of her Arctic parka, her right hand buried in the pocket beside it, her left hand freezing like her legs. She dogged after Michael, feeling like his puppy. She had become acquainted with the concept of dog following master from Björn Rolvag, the Icelandic. Rolvag and his dog were inseparable. Hrothgar, his master's shadow. Rolvag and Hrothgar now explored further along the beach on their own, the perennially green-clad Icelandic policeman always solitary except for the dog that sniffed at him, nuzzled against him, while he himself was almost invariably silent. Bjorn Rolvag gave the impression of considerable intelligence, but since she spoke no Icelandic and he spoke neither German nor English, it was impossible to converse with him beyond a smile or nod. Michael was examining the sand near her feet, and suddenly aware of him, she took a halting step back.
What is it, Michael?
Heel mark from a Vietnam-era combat boot. See?
He gestured with his right index finger to some ridges in the sand that seemed barely distinguishable in the beam of his flashlight from ordinary patterns in the sand. But she assumed Michael Rourke was right. Paul Rubinstein and Han, the Chinese intelligence agent, each dropped into a crouch, flanking Michael. As she looked down at them, she had the silly thought that some uninformed observer might think that three men were proposing to her at once. As a little girl, she read forbidden books her mother stored in a trunk in the hall closet, the books so old and musty-smelling that their memory was almost physical to her. And in these books, men would sometimes drop to one knee and profess their love and sue for the hand of their lady. Michael Rourke stood to his full height, and suddenly she was looking up at him, into his eyes, his face intermittently in shadow and in light from the flashlight beams playing over the beach. The surf was loud, the wind louder, but as Michael spoke again, she had no difficulty discerning his voice.
It appears he was alone. Now, why would Natalia have left him?
She wanted to tell Michael that she thought she knew why. Natalia loved Michael's father, and Michael's father was married to Michael's mother, Sarah, and they expected a baby. And Natalia felt useless and afraid inside. It was the way she herself had felt after the death of Michael's wife had made him available, and she had found herself insanely in love with Michael. But Michael refused all affection in his all-consuming sadness and lust for revenge. Then, one night, Michael came to her, and she knew it would somehow... She didn't know what.
I don't know, Michael.
She really didn't know why Natalia would have walked away from John Rourke here on the beach. She would not have walked away from Michael. Han's radio was making static sounds, and she heard a voice that would have been one of the Defense Force people speaking through it to him. He answered in Chinese and then announced in English,
"Your friend Mr. Rolvag has found something."
Michael, Paul in step with him, took off down the beach. Maria Leuden, hugging her coat around her, both hands in her pockets now, ran after him. The wind felt good in her hair, despite the cold and damp. She felt more alive since leaving New Germany than she had ever felt there. The only way she would return to it would be if Michael took her there, because she would always be with him. She kept running, breathless by the time she stopped. Rolvag was stooped over, peering into the sand, his huge dog sniffing, whining, sniffing, moving between Rolvag and some spot in the sand further along the beach, running, skidding in the sand on his hind feet, running again. Michael rose out of a crouch next to Rolvag, clapped him on the shoulder, grabbed a handful of Hrothgar at the scruff of the neck, and petted the animal vigorously.
Yes, you are.
He looked up at Maria.
Bjorn seems to think there was a fight here. Several men with strange-looking footgear. I think they must have been wearing scuba gear.
Scuba?
Self-contained underwater breathing apparatus for diving underwater.
Oh, yes. But what would these scuba swimmers be doing here?
Logic supported by the physical evidence dictates that for some reason, Natalia and my father split up further down the beach, back where I found that heel print. And then they got involved in some sort of fight here with these people in flippers.
Flippers? Oh, flippers!
At some point, Natalia and my father must have gotten together again. But then there are these deeper ridges in the sand as if something was dragged into the water.
Your father and Natalia?
Paul Rubinstein stood up.
No, not heel prints or anything like that. Heavy objects, almost appearing cylindrical in shape. Most of the impressions are gone now, wiped away with the tide coming in, Maria. Looks like big tanks or something.
Michael hugged her to him, and she rested her head against his right shoulder, his parka rough against her cheek. She liked the feeling, and she felt warmed now.
Must be Karamazov.
She stared up into his face, visible only partly in the light of Paul's flashlight. When Paul spoke, she still watched Michael.
If Karamazov's been behind these raids, Han's been telling us about...
Your Soviet nemesis. Perhaps he was preparing for some time to penetrate China in search of his nuclear weapons. If he has sea power...
Maria Leuden could see Michael's eyes now, narrowed almost to slits.
If he has sea power, then he'll be using his divers to go after those missiles, to recover them from the train wreck.
Either a submarine, a... Shit, an island, maybe.
Surely Dr. Leuten's friends in New Germany would have detected such an island. Or for that matter, could they not have detected a submarine, This is most baffling.
You've been experiencing these raids for some time now, and never an inkling of the source, Han?
Maria nuzzled closer to Michael, burying her nose in the front of her coat.
This is the first defeat. The first two defeats of these seaborne invaders have encountered at our hands. They strike with uncanny quickness and withdraw into the sea, below the surface where we cannot follow them. And then at sunset...
He threw up his hands in disgust.
They just exploded bombs attached to their own people. That is barbaric. Would even this Karamazov...
We have encountered these personal explosive devices before. They prevent the taking and interrogation of prisoners. The inspection of equipment to determine origin. I believe the English word is insidious.
Could be. Maria?
Michael looked down at her, touching the tips of his fingers to her chin, raising her face.
Do you have any idea what your country might have in terms of under-ocean capabilities?
Our commandos have no training in undersea operations, as far as I know. But they don't tell archaeologists everything.
All right. Open to suggestions?
We have to find Karamazov's headquarters, Michael, and then get inside.
If these men who attacked the power station took my father and Natalia and took them alive, then once these guys realized who they had, they'd get them to Karamazov as quickly as possible. Promotion time. So, if they survived the fight and were somehow immobilized or so outnumbered that they had no choice, Natalia and my father would still be alive. If one of Karamazov's men captured a Rourke and didn't bring his prize to Karamazov for disposition, he'd be in such deep trouble that he'd wish he'd never been born. No. If whoever these troops were took them alive, they're still alive. And if they were killed, there would have been no sense in taking off the bodies. Their presence was already detected if this took place after the raid, or soon would have been if it took place before the raid.
Michael looked up and down the beach, then out to sea.
It seems likely they were using this as some sort of staging area and spotted my dad and Natalia by accident. Shit.
I'll get Lieutenant Kiefler and his people airborne. Maybe, hell.
Paul Rubinstein stomped off across the sand into the night, the beam of his flashlight bouncing up and down as he cut over a dune and toward the rocks beyond. Then even his backlit silhouette disappeared.
I regret that harm may have befallen such a fine man as your father and such a noble woman as Major Chemerovna, Michael. I speak on behalf of the chairman. I am sure, and certainly on my own behalf. Whatever can be done, I am truly sorry.
Han walked away along the surf. Rolvag, perhaps because he was unable to understand English, had drifted off already. Maria seeing him now for an instant along the beach, then losing him as he passed behind some rocks. She was alone with Michael. He just held her, didn't speak. It was hard to consider the possibility of John Rourke's death, and when she tried, it frightened her. Because to consider the mortality of the father was to consider the mortality of the son, and without him...
Michael?
He turned toward her, and she felt his arms encircle her, and she took her hands from her pockets and inched them up under his coat and around his waist. His left hand reached to her face and plucked away her glasses. She touched her lips to his fingers. He brought his mouth down over hers, and she sank against him. In their short time together, she felt at times a desperation in him. She felt it in him tonight. Rourke crawled toward Natalia, and Natalia toward him. At first, they sat back to back to work at loosening each other's bonds. Then, finally, in desperation, Rourke dropped to his chest behind her and tried to work at the restraints with his teeth. After a few moments, he realized that perhaps a rat could have gnawed through them, but no human could. And it began again. The tall man carried Rourke's knives and Natalia's knife in his hands, holding them as if his palms were somehow the baskets of scales as he spoke.
Translate.
This officer is Major Karenin.
The non-naval rank here aboard this undersea vessel compounded the mystery in Rourke's mind.
Stripper and searcher.
John Rourke could not react to the words because they had been spoken in Russian. He felt his neck and shoulders tense, saw the muscles around Natalia's eyes tighten.
We must strip and search the woman.
You bastard! You cannot do that!
Apparently, there was no need for translation, intonation and facial expression sufficient to convey meaning. Karenin set down the edged weapons, then stepped toward him. Rourke let his head sag away an instant before impact to diminish the effect of the blow. When Karenin re-entered the compartment, aside from the men who originally accompanied him and the conventionally uniformed translator, there were three others, two of them women, all three of them wearing white coveralls with something that could have been medical insignia emblazoned over the heart. Each wore a similar insignia, like a shoulder brassard. All three of them, dark-haired, stood nearly Karenin's own height, the women included. And all three of them looked simultaneously unpleasant and bored. The boredom in the eyes of one of the women seemed to wane now as she approached Natalia.
You cannot do this to me! You searched us with your machine! We have no weapons! Please!
First the woman, then the man.
Who are you? I demand to see your superior!
He wants to see your superior.
Karenin approached Rourke, hands easily on his hips, his mouth smiling, but his eyes deadly.
I am Major Spetsnaz, Olaf Karenin. Since our last visit, a force of commandos under my best officer has returned to this vessel through another airlock, and I have learned that they have suffered significant losses, largely due to two other men dressed as you are and armed as you were with antique cartridge firearms. More Germans? More explorers searching for signs of life on the barren Earth? We shall see. And during the attempt to subdue yourself and this woman, you claim as your wife, several of my men, including a member of my personal staff, were killed or seriously injured. Is this, perhaps, part of what they teach at the Academy for German explorers, huh?
The balding translator turned to his task.
This officer is Major of Spetsnaz Olaf Karenin.
Rourke ignored the droning translation, trying to think of something to say or do to gain some time. The bonds at his wrists and ankles were of some type of nearly translucent plastic, tubular and approximately a quarter inch in diameter, and, so it seemed, as impossible to snap as they had been to work loose or bite through. Karenin walked to the center of the compartment. He picked up the three knives he had just put down. One was Natalia's balisong, another, the little A.G. Russell knife, the third, Rourke's Grain Life Support System 10. As the balding translator concluded, Karenin began to muse aloud.
I find the firearms hopelessly primitive, regardless of what aesthetic appeal they might once have had. But these knives I find quite interesting indeed, each unique in its own way. One is marked Bally Song with USA appearing beneath it, and another a picture of stick-legged bird with what is apparently a name and then words which use the Roman alphabet. And this little black knife, a very strange-sounding name for German. I think, Russell?
The woman, who looked as though she was going to enjoy it, grabbed Natalia by the hair and snapped Natalia's head back.
I must tell the commander something. Please.
Rourke looked beseechingly toward the translator, Vznovsky. Vznovsky smiled for the first time and drew his shoulders back.
He wants to tell you something, comrade.
A look of amusement entered Karenin's face.
Wait with the woman for a moment only. The man's tongue has perhaps loosened.
Rourke could see Natalia's eyes as Vznovsky translated. Karenin leaned closer toward him. Rourke eyed the knives, but neither the grain nor the rustle was unsheathed. And if Karenin had never seen a knife like Natalia's balisong, he wouldn't be able to get it into action fast enough.
I suppose that you have us at your mercy.
Karenin's head was very close. John Rourke threw his weight forward, snapping his head toward Karenin's face. Rourke missed the Soviet's nose as Karenin dodged, but Karenin didn't pull back quite quickly enough. The crown of Rourke's head cracked Karenin over the right eye. The Russian fell back, blood oozing between his fingers the instant after his hands dropped the knives and went to his face. Rourke saw Vznovsky reaching for him from the left edge of his peripheral vision. He hurled his weight back against the two men who supported him, their hands banded at his biceps, hammering the one on his left side into Vznovsky, the balding translator impacting the bulkhead near the watertight door. Rourke toppled forward, trying to drop to his knees. His knees took most of the impact, but his body continued to move. He fell on his face against the steel plates of the compartment floor. He saw Karenin's foot and tried rolling away from it. But now an explosion detonated in his already aching head, and Rourke slid across the floor from the impact. Karenin moved across the compartment in two swift strides, the big grain survival knife in his right fist, hacking downward. Rourke tried to roll clear, but Karenin moved faster, the primary edge of the Life Support System 10 flashing past John Rourke's face. Rourke felt it against his throat. Karenin didn't speak. He didn't shift the knife. John Rourke didn't breathe. Michael Rourke slipped off his parka as he entered the security bunker of the powerhouse. Han, already there, had changed from his traditional Chinese attire to the black battle dress utilities of the Chinese army. Paul Rubinstein stood beside him. Michael threw down his coat and joined them by the illuminated map table. Paul looked up.
I got Lieutenant Kiefler airborne, and then I contacted Captain Hartmann with German field headquarters. Hoffman puts Karamazov's position is about 400 kilometers from us in what used to be Chenchen.
Yes, Chenchen. Across Bohai, before the Dragon Wind.
It's almost twice that distance by land, though.
Michael looked at him, then back to the illuminated map table.
Could he have had a sea base here all along that we just didn't know about?
He looked at Han. The man smiled, then seemed to shrug his shoulders.
Possible, but highly dubious, Michael.
Before the night of the war, there was a gigantic Soviet naval base at Kamran Bay. What if part of it survived, somehow? And what if Karamazov was looking to get those nuclear warheads and somehow get them to Kamran Bay and be able to use them from there? I mean, there might still be hardware there that might be able to be restored.
Michael Rourke stared at the map, trying to think. They were at Lushun. At one time, it had been called Port Arthur. Almost at the same latitude across the bay, almost large enough to accommodate a nation the size of Greece before the night of the war, the hero marshal, Vladimir Karamazov, and a Soviet force numbering into the thousands, waited. With an expeditionary force of Karamazov's personal KGB elite corps, there had been a bold attempt to expropriate a vast portion of the pre-war nuclear arsenal of the People's Republic of China. The Soviet Union and China engaged in a devastating land war following the so-called Night of the War, the all-out thermonuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. Then came what the Chinese called the Dragon Wind, or Great Conflagration, when the ionized atmosphere caught fire and extinguished the majority of life on Earth, and forced those who could survive underground to wait until the planet sufficiently restored itself to the point where life could be supported on the surface. Karamazov seemed intent on the acquisition of more nuclear weapons with which to obliterate all life on Earth forever. But his greatest passion, his ultimate motivation, was simpler and very clear. Karamazov wanted the death of Major Natalia Anastasia Temerovna, who now, in name only, was his wife. And Karamazov wanted the death of John Thomas Rourke, whom Karamazov blamed for taking Natalia from him, and who, in this latter case, rightly, Karamazov blamed for once before destroying his plans to be master of the Earth. Why had Karamazov taken his armies to Tianjin? From what base of operations did those who had kidnapped Natalia and Michael's father, John Rourke, originate? Had the 5 centuries, while Earth restored itself to sufficiently sustain life, merely been an interlude between the first battle and the last, in a war that would forever end war by forever ending life?
I'm going to Tianjin. If Karamazov's got them, they'll wind up there.
Paul Rubinstein, Michael's friend, his brother-in-law, straightened.
I'll go with you, Michael. I think the government of China needs to be represented as well. Perhaps my meager skills may be of some service, Michael.
Michael Rourke looked across the table to both men. There was nothing to say. They forced Rourke to his knees, the LS-10 knife to his throat, his head pulled back with a fist knotted into his hair. They had made him watch as Natalia undressed, ordered to do so if she did not wish to see her husband's throat slit. Natalia stood naked in the center of the compartment beneath a massive grappling hook. But her head was raised, and there was determination in her eyes, not resignation. Instruments passed over her body, searching for explosives or electronic monitoring devices, Rourke deduced. But there had been no actual physical search. As he bitterly suspected, Karenin ordered her to disrobe as a means of demoralizing her, showing his power, and from the look on Karenin's face, because he liked looking at her naked. After some time, Karenin, standing very close to her, assaying her, not touching her, she was allowed to dress and was then rebound. New restraints were used. The plastic was apparently only removable by cutting. Then she was forced to her knees with a knife placed at her throat. John Rourke was released, his bonds cut. It was as if Karenin, whose right eye was blackened and who was blood-encrusted over the eyebrow, were challenging him. Karenin, despite his obvious fascination with Natalia, would kill her, Rourke decided. Because of that, John Rourke had no choice but to cooperate. Rourke stood at the center of the room and undressed. He handed over the battered brown leather bomber jacket, the empty double LSE shoulder rig, the light blue snap front cowboy shirt, his combat boots, the faded blue Levi's. The belt went when his knives and the Spark six-pack and a half dozen spare magazines for his pistols were confiscated sometime before he woke. He tugged off his socks, threw them to Karenin's men for examination.
I hope they smell!
Undressed, he stood with his hands at his sides. One of the female attendants stared at him. Natalia closed her eyes. John Rourke stared at Karenin. While there was life, as the expression went, there was hope. But the possibilities were rapidly diminishing, leading to a situation in which there was nothing to lose. Rourke continued to stare at Karenin. As the instruments, which were to determine if his body cavities concealed explosives or electronic monitoring devices, passed over him, Rourke saw Karenin's eyes flicker. Recognition in his eyes, John Rourke knew. Recognition that if there was a way, Major Karenin would be a dead man. The ship's brig lay 100 feet or so forward of the compartment where they had initially been held and interrogated. It was facing the starboard torpedo room. There were no bars. As the last guard walked out of the cell, he flipped a switch arming bands of blue light at the top and bottom of the cell entrance. The man threw one of the cut-off plastic restraints into the opening between the bands of light. The plastic cord smoldered, then burst into flame. The falling ashes crackled in the lower bar of blue light. The man walked away. John Rourke turned to Natalia Timurovna. She smiled strangely, then came into his arms.
You should say, this is another fine.
He hugged her tight against him, knowing the rest. Oliver Hardy's famous line to Stan Laurel, and a fine mess it was this time. Rourke glanced over his shoulder.
I think we can safely discount trying to walk through the doorway.
The ashes of the plastic cord were nearly gone.
Do you have any idea where we're going?
Rourke simply shook his head. He drew her close to him again and touched his lips to her left ear. The brig would be bugged for sound, and though they saw no evidence of cameras, he guessed some type of visual coverage was also working, perhaps advanced fiber optics.
We need names, a solid cover story. Thank God I left my wallet with the rest of my gear. I still carry my Georgia driver's license and concealed weapons permit.
She touched her lips to his right cheek, then brushed against his left ear.
Anna, I used that name once.
All right. Michael used to joke that we should have named him Wolfgang. He won't mind if I borrow it for a while.
I dream at night sometimes that somehow I am your wife. That you would call me your wife, but like this, it...
We'll get out of here. This is a tough one, but we will make it out of here.
He wanted to believe his lie. Thanks to a healing salve, which he still had to apply to portions of his arms and legs and back, that was the difficult part, where the burns were the worst, and the fine care he received in the hospital, he was as fit as ever and better rested than in years. The Chinese ran fine hospitals. He wanted to rejoin Michael Rourke and the others and learned the only way to get to Lushun, the Chinese being without air transportation, was to take the train, so he took it. When he left the train at the conglomeration of prefabricated huts, military tents, and a massive and apparently explosion-damaged fusion power station, he was met by a slightly built Chinese. The man spoke no German, but excellent, if odd-sounding, English. His name was Wing Tse Chow, and he was a captain of the army attached to Herr Han and Michael Rourke and their expedition to Tianjin. He handed a letter to Hammerschmidt, who unfolded it.
This will take a moment, Captain Wing.
Certainly, Captain Hammerschmidt.
It was cold and damp here. Hammerschmidt supposed he noticed it more after the sterile, temperature-controlled environment of the hospital. He realized he was moving his lips as he read.
Otto, my father and Natalia are missing. We have strong reason to believe that they were taken after encountering a superior force of Soviet commandos who were part of an attack force on the power station at Lushun. Our only hope of effecting their rescue is to go to where they are likely being held now or will soon be brought. Karamazov's headquarters at Chinsin. If you are well enough, we could use your help and experience. Michael.
Hammerschmidt folded the letter and placed it in an outside pocket of his parka.
Aside from a few things that I do have, Captain Ving, I will require your assistance to re-equip.
This has been provided for, Captain Hammerschmidt. Welcome, sir.
Hammerschmidt followed Wing off the platform toward a waiting electric car. Michael Rourke learned of Otto Hammerschmidt's release from the hospital from Han after the Chinese intelligence agent contacted the First City to notify his superiors in the government, and the chairman in particular, of the decision to set out for Tianjin. He learned also that Hammerschmidt would be arriving on the next special from the First City. For that reason, he decided to wait. It meant a delay of liftoff time amounting to approximately 18 minutes if Wing Tse Chao made good time from the train depot. Considering Hammerschmidt's abilities, he considered the delay justified. Michael stared up at the dirt road leading to Lushun. The 18-minute delay was getting to him now, just waiting. He felt the pressure of Maria Lloyden's hand on his hand, and he turned to gaze into her face.
How are you going to tell your mother and sister?
I was going to do it. But Paul said he'd contact Annie by radio, tell her. Let Annie decide if we should tell my mom. Maybe I let Paul talk me into it too easily. I don't know.
She leaned up and kissed him on the cheek. In the distance, he saw one of the Chinese electric cars coming, and he saw a German field cap waving through the open window. Hammerschmidt was coming. Paul Rubinstein sat at the co-pilot's controls, the helicopter pilot having left the cockpit to give him privacy. There was a lot of static, and Annie's voice sounded distorted. But still, it was Annie's voice, and the sound of her voice warmed him.
Say again, Paul? Over.
Annie, your dad and Natalia are missing. But we think they're all right. I repeat, we think they are all right. Over.
Paul, I'm coming. Over.
No, you're not. Your mother needs you if you decide to tell Sarah. This situation could deteriorate instantly if Karamazov moves his forces. I can't say anything more about it. And Claire, over?
I'll tell my mother, but I'm coming. Don't forbid me to. Please. Please, Paul. Over.
Paul Rubinstein's right fist balled over the microphone.
I'll arrange for you to be brought to the First City. I love you. Yeah, tell her about your dad. I'll keep you informed. Michael sends his love. I love you. Paul out.
God. He threw the microphone down on the seat as he stood, almost striking his head on the cockpit overhead. There was no other way than to let her come, he told himself. No other way. She was Annie Rubinstein now, but she would always be a Rourke.